over the last week, I listened to you, and in the process, I found my own voice.
Well, thank you so much. I am still fired up and ready to go.
There have been three races so far. I've gotten two silvers and one gold.
Tonight, we sure showed them what a comeback looks like.
Well, there they are. They were in, all of them, resplendent in many ways, although they, not all of them won that the pollsters said would win, and some of them did. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and the Republican that walked away with the race last night. No one's really surprised by this one, John McCain. He's won it before. He kind of knows how to do that. The big question is, where will he go from here? What did surprise almost everyone, and it was interesting to watch the press in kind of this unfolding and increasing surprise throughout the evening last night as the returns for the New Hampshire primaries came back. What did surprise everyone was the projections for the Democratic race and the actual outcome. We're going to be talking about the New Hampshire primaries here for the next half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in this Wednesday, 9th of January. Dr. Jeff Walls is our guest. You can join us as well, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. In about an hour, we're going to be starting the third hour and starting some open lines. The question we put on the table is, it's a simple one and there are no wrong answers. What is your favorite Bible verse? What is your favorite Bible verse and why? You might be able to guess what the favorite Bible verse of most people is. John 3:16, of course. But what's yours and why? Answer that question in an hour during open lines, last hour of Issues, etc. Dr. Jeff Walls is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and he's co-author of the book Lutheran Pastors and Politics. Dr. Walls, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd. Good to be back.
How do you explain how wrong all of the data was going in for the Democratic race in New Hampshire last night and how surprised everyone was when the returns returned?
Yes, very, very hard to explain. A lot of pollsters, I think, are shaking their heads this morning. Well, one thing we do know is that Hillary Clinton did put significant resources into New Hampshire, and despite the fact that she was projected to be down by 10 points, 12 points, 8 points, clearly it seems that she benefited from the debate on Saturday. She has claimed that that was a turning point for her, and it may have been, certainly among some voters. And also seems like we had a few more independents who came and voted perhaps for her and the Democratic side rather than voting on the Republican side. In New Hampshire, you can pick either side, Democratic or Republican, to vote in for the primary. Otherwise, though, Todd, very, again, difficult to explain, especially given all the momentum that Barack Obama had coming into New Hampshire. It was a win for Hillary, but three percentage points is still a fairly tight race.
We were talking off the air with the previous guest, and he had commented that it wasn't so much an upset victory for Hillary Clinton. That wasn't the story. The story was everybody going in misjudged the situation. That's the real story.
I think to a point, certainly. And on the Democratic side, you had John Edwards, who's kind of lurking around in third place, wanting to be this kind of anti-establishment candidate. And yet Clinton and Barack Obama, with their theme of change, tended to carry the day. And what I found interesting, especially, too, I guess, in trying to read the tea leaves in New Hampshire, a couple of things. We thought Hillary would do fairly well among women, and she did. According to exit polls, she defeated Obama among women 46% to 34%. And I guess I was even more interested to see how Clinton did with younger versus older voters, because we've heard so much about how Obama has really energized younger voters, younger Democratic voters, and that was true in New Hampshire, where Obama, according to these exit polls, beat Hillary among the younger voters, 18 to 24, roughly 3 to 1. Yet, if you look down the age column, beginning 40 to 49, 50 to 64, 65 and older. You see Hillary doing very well among these populations in the Democratic side, and especially, although only 13% of this sect, still she got 48% to 32 of the 65 and older vote. So I think one thing going in is we didn't know exactly how well she would do with some of these different age cohorts and exactly how well she'd do with women, but apparently she did very well with both.
You mentioned the debates, which she of course, is citing as one of those turning points. Do you think that female observers of those debates or of the snippets they may have seen in the news felt that this debate was essentially two men, Barack Obama and John Edwards, ganging up on a woman, Hillary Clinton, in that Saturday night debate?
Yeah, to an extent that was the case. And I think also there was the situation on Monday, of course, after the debate, where Hillary was asked in one of these forums about how she was doing with the campaign, and she had, I guess, more of a kind of a sensitive moment there where she expressed, that she's doing okay, but that it's kind of tough to keep going, and she just kind of hopes for the best. And that was kind of, a human side we saw of Hillary. Her critique and certainly where people criticize her is that she seems so, in a sense, programmed and just so polished and smooth. And I think Monday's exchange, in addition to the Saturday debate, tended to kind of humanize her a little bit more. And certainly I think that appealed to more of the female population.
What's the difference between what we saw, and I'm not talking about who won, who lost. I'm talking about the segments of America that we saw on display in the Iowa caucuses versus the New Hampshire primaries.
A significant difference, and we saw this especially on the Republican side. We saw Mike Huckabee, of course, in Iowa do very well, win Iowa, in large part because of the social conservatives, the evangelical Christians who came out in large numbers. We saw this in Iowa. We've seen this in previous years with Pat Robertson and others doing very well in Iowa. And so what Iowa has, it tends to be, of course, a little more rural, but certainly more religious from an evangelical perspective than New Hampshire. And New Hampshire, on the license plate, it says, I believe, live free or die. And New Hampshire has this kind of independent political streak in it, more so than Iowa, where New Hampshire voters in its primary, again, can kind of decide, do I want to vote Republican? Do I want to vote Democratic? Do I want to be more independent? And generally in New Hampshire, for a number of reasons, we've seen economic issues play a larger role in that primary than, for example, social issues like we've seen in Iowa. And that's seems to me really to be the battle playing out, at least on the Republican side, is you have the more kind of traditional Republican candidates who might be, for example, a Mitt Romney, a more establishment candidate. And then you have this kind of insurgent candidate, Mike Huckabee, certainly socially conservative, but also a tinge of populism in his message as well, which doesn't necessarily resonate that well with some of the kind of old guard of the Republican Party. So you've got those two, those two kind of battling, and then, perhaps McCain prevails in some of these states coming up. I guess we'll have to see.
What people are looking at, of course, is who won, who lost. But in most cases here, aren't we really talking about either a direct or an indirect election of delegates for national party conventions in these caucuses and primaries?
Exactly, Todd. Right. Exactly. So. Yeah, it's important for a candidate to say I won this race like Hillary Clinton, or the big thing is that I beat expectations, and that's kind of a classic sandbagging argument where you downplay your own expectations and I'm not going to do well, I'll be fourth or fifth, and then you finish third and say I exceeded expectations. So that's important from a momentum perspective, a media perspective, and also a money perspective, that the money in these races and the following races tends to follow those candidates who are leading or doing well. But you're right. Ultimately, what we're doing is watching the delegates stack up for the respective candidates as they pursue the nominations this coming summer in Denver and the Twin Cities. And what is possible, which we haven't seen for quite some time, is that we could go to one of these conventions, the Republican convention, I believe, in the Twin Cities, St. Paul, Democratic convention, I believe, is in Denver, and we could arrive at one of these conventions without one candidate having essentially secured or locked up that nomination. So there's still quite a ways to go, and yeah, we are on a delegate to watch now.
When was the last time that happened?
I want to say it was back in the 50s. I would have to do some research to determine exactly when, but I want to say it was either 56 or 52, although I'm not positive, to be honest.
Does the real kind of raw delegate count for party nomination, does that mean that although some of these primaries are earlier and earlier, the real determiner here is going to be Super Tuesday, February 5th?
Yeah, certainly. If you look at February 5th, you just have a large number, a plethora of states, Democratic and Republican, big states holding primaries, primarily primaries. And, yeah, the Super Tuesday has actually been with us for probably 20 years now, where we have one date that we have a lot of these, on which we have a lot of these contests. And it used to be focused or concentrated more on the South, and now it's kind of spread out a little bit more. But certainly candidates who do well on Super Tuesday are in a good position, especially in this very compacted calendar with Super Tuesday coming up in just a little over a month. That's why you look at a candidate like, for instance, Rudy Giuliani, who didn't, of course, do too well in New Hampshire or Iowa, but he's still making the case that, you know, I can make a go of this because the big states, the states that tend to have more delegates, are still coming up. And we see some of that on the Democratic side, too, with John Edwards, finished third in Iowa, but he's saying as well that, hey, some of the big states are coming up, a lot of delegates are out there. Bill Richardson saying the same thing. So the early states are important in really setting the tone and in playing the expectations game and in bringing in money. But yes, ultimately, the 5th will be key. And in fact, I think it'll be interesting after that. For example, I know Wisconsin has here in Wisconsin, we have a February 19 primary with, I believe, one other state. And you know, depending on what happens on the 5th, Wisconsin could get a lot of attention for that primary as well.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. live this Wednesday. It's the 9th of January. We're talking about the New Hampshire primaries and beyond. Dr. Jeff Walls is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Our call-in numbers, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Your thoughts on the McCain victory in New Hampshire last night, and do you think this buys him the kind of momentum he needs for the more immediate primaries that he faces, Michigan and South Carolina?
Yeah, it certainly buys him momentum. McCain, of course, won in 2000 and has always kind of had a stronghold in New Hampshire because of his appeal to some independents, among others. And, yeah, it's especially key that he won last night because coming up you have, as you said, Michigan, and that's kind of Mitt Romney's backyard where he grew up. So that'll be difficult for McCain, and one would expect, I think, at least that Romney would do fairly well in Michigan. And then South Carolina is where McCain really kind of lost hold of things back in 2000. George W. Bush, our president, did well there, especially among evangelicals and the Christian vote. And it was in 2000 where, again, McCain, and he's talked about this, where he perhaps wasn't as forthright about certain issues. Back then, he was critical of some of the leaders of the so-called Christian right, and that certainly, those comments didn't endear him to the voters in South Carolina. So, you know, I think he's learned his lesson there, but again, you look at a South Carolina that would seem to be fit and ready for Huckabee again to do at least fairly well, given the makeup of the state. But yeah, certainly McCain doing well in Iowa, doing well in New Hampshire, winning New Hampshire, certainly does buy him some time to get to February 5th.
How do you explain the so-called Huckabee boom? Is this just another Tom Harkin who wins in Iowa and then disappears eventually?
It could be. Again, Iowa has propelled Huckabee, and people have said, as we talked about, that maybe Iowa's not as representative. But I guess what I see in Huckabee and McCain to a point, although maybe less so, is kind of a sense among some Republicans and some independents that that they want a new flavor, they want a new kind of sense of the Republican Party. I mentioned Mitt Romney before, Rudy Giuliani. They tend to be more representative of kind of the Reagan Republican Party, tax-cutting party, strong on social issues, strong with business issues, and that's a decent model. But it seems to me, just kind of anecdotally, and I haven't looked at a lot of data on this, that there are some Republicans out there who want a new kind of Republican Party, and even looking at, for example, the more Christian or evangelical voters. Yes, they're very strong on social issues, pro-life, opposed to gay marriage, those kind of things, but also a number of them are concerned about economic issues, concerned about environmental, global warming, those kind of issues. So it may be, Huckabee may be a bit of a sensation, but I tend to think he's going to have some staying power, especially among some of the party who, want to move away from some of the more traditional Republican moorings that they've seen, for example, President Bush espouse.
Mitt Romney is claiming, as he said in his concession speech last night, a gold and two silvers. He won in Wyoming. That was hardly noticed, of course, by the national press. And he came in second in Iowa and New Hampshire. Does he have to win Michigan or another state soon to really remain a viable candidate in the Republican race?
Yeah, I think he does. He certainly needs, I think, to probably win Michigan again, given his connection to Michigan and given the expectations there. And I kind of like this symbolism he uses, harkening back to I'm sure his management or his leadership of the Olympics back in Salt Lake City. He was in charge of that, using the medal analogies. But yeah, to be a viable, and again to bring money in, he's going to need to win one of these times fairly soon. I think even before February 5th, because if he's not winning these races, then clearly somebody else is, and it could be McCain, it could be Huckabee, and if it's one of those two, then again it puts them further ahead, and I think it sets certain expectations among Republicans that maybe Romney isn't exactly the candidate that we want. And now I know Romney has said he's going to take, I believe he said something like more direction of his party or more control of his, of his campaign. So I think there's a sense that he feels he's been maybe a little too programmed, a little too polished, and he's going to be, if not more off the cuff, at least a little more natural or human in his own sense. And perhaps that'll help him, although, again, his wing of the party that he's representing, we'll have to see if it holds off against some of these, McCain and Huckabee challenges.
Rudolph Giuliani, you mentioned before, he's kind of made himself the dark horse here, hoping for the light to come over the top of the hill in a couple of weeks. Does he have to win Florida?
He has to do very well in Florida, if not win it. And again, he's played some of the expectation games too, where he said, "Hey, I didn't put much time and money into Iowa." He said the same thing about New Hampshire, even though in Iowa, actually, he had I wouldn't say a formidable operation, but a decent operation in Iowa, and he did not do well in Iowa. Just checking this out here, 8.6% in New Hampshire for Giuliani, not too far from New York, his home state, so you would have thought he'd do a little better there. And again, he's going to make the case, which is the case I think that Obama might make, at least implicitly, is from a party perspective, I think Giuliani will say, "I'm the most electable Republican come November of 08, because I think he'll say I espouse some of these basic Republican values, and yet I can appeal across the moderate lines on some other issues where he's certainly been at least more liberal to a point. So it's interesting to call him an underdog, certainly.
Senator Bob Dole, I remember when he was running for president, pointed out, and it's become now conventional wisdom, if it wasn't before you said it, and that is, you know, to win the presidency, you need three things. You need people to recognize your name. You need money, and you need a machine. And it seems as though Hillary Clinton has a machine. I don't think the Clinton machine really has shut down since Bill Clinton tried running for the president the first time he did. I think it's been in full swing for years and decades. She has money. But then there's John Edwards, who's got a lot of money. Mitt Romney's got more money than probably all of them put together, and he's funding a large part of his own campaign. What in the end do you think is really going to prove on the Republican and Democratic side to be the most important factor in that triad of necessity?
Yeah, the triad of necessity. It seems to me the most important thing, you're going to have name recognition among all these candidates, but the key will be when you talk about, and I think the money is going to be there too for most of these folks, but I think the key will be when you talk about the folks on the ground, the grassroots supporters, and their ability to get out and to make their case to other Democrats or other Republicans. And I just found it striking looking, for example, at some of this exit polling. The one question was, who do you think is best positioned to win the nomination? And this is on the Democratic side. I don't think it was posed on the Republican side, but it was 52-26 among respondents. 52% said Obama, 26% said Hillary Clinton. So you had even people who had voted for Hillary in the primary who said that Obama is going to be the more electable candidate come fall. And I think that's going to be a key among the triad that you mentioned, would be the case that supporters can make to other supporters about who is the most electable candidate come November. And on the Republican side, I think McCain is already making that case, and his people are making that case, that he is moderate enough on some issues to reach across the aisle and to at least bring in some of that moderate electorate. So to me, it's going to be the supporters, it's going to be the infrastructure, the people on the ground who make this case and who, you know, go door to door and try to get their friends and neighbors and acquaintances out to vote.
Can you give us 5 minutes on the other side of the break, Dr. Walls?
Sure.
Dr. Jeff Walls is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. By the way, Concordia University, Wisconsin has a satellite campus right here in St. Louis. It's called Concordia University St. Louis Center. Now, Concordia University St. Louis Center is designed for working adults. That's why classes meet one night a week. They are easy to find on the map at 44 and 270. They offer associates, bachelors, and MBAs. For more information about Concordia University St. Louis Center, give them a call, 314-984-8840, 984-8840, or check out the What's New section of our website tonight, issuesetc.org, Concordia University St. Louis Center, professional education with a personal touch. Dr. Jeff Walls will be with us for a few more minutes to talk about the New Hampshire primaries and beyond. I got a couple of questions. One of them has to do with the speeches. That's what I watch for. I mean, I watch to see who's going to win and who's going to lose. But what really interests me, and had to stay up kind of late last night to get all of them in, what really interests me are the victory speeches and the concession speeches. And one thing I've noticed is it's kind of hard this early in the race to tell the difference between a victory speech and a concession speech. Everybody's still ready to fight and everybody's still sounding like they're winning the elections. They kind of have to. We'll compare speeches with Dr. Jeff Walls after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
On Sunday, January 13th, vocal and instrumental groups from the Concordia Seminary community will participate in an Epiphany celebration. The Chapel of St. Timothy and St. Titus on the campus of Concordia Seminary is the setting, and AM 850 KFUO will broadcast the event live. We encourage you to attend this special Epiphany celebration, but if you cannot, then listen at 3 p.m. Sunday to the live broadcast here on AM 850 KFUO, Inspirational Christian Radio for the World.
Why not send a high school age man from your congregation to Taste of the Sim, January 19th through the 21st, on the campus of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis? Taste of the Sim gives high school men the opportunity to experience seminary life. For more information on Taste of the Sim, January 19th through the 21st, at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, visit the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call 1-800-822-9545.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A lieutenant commander in the U.S. Coast Guard is being forced to accept a vaccination for hepatitis A, despite his request for a religious exemption. The vaccine was produced from cells that were taken from an aborted baby. Joseph Healy is Catholic and cites church teaching that abortion is wrong. Steve Jordahl reports the Coast Guard thinks Healy misunderstands his faith.
Healy applied for his exemption on religious grounds and provided documentation from his Catholic faith. The Coast Guard's refusal states, quote, "The excerpts you cited from the Catechism do not state that these immunizations are against the religious tenets of the Catholic Church." Jennifer Kimball of the Catholic-based Culture of Life Foundation says, first of all, the Coast Guard is wrong.
By them, they're saying, well, the church doesn't have a pronouncement on this. It's really irrelevant. The fact of the matter is it is immoral. The church knows and is aware that it's immoral.
Secondly, they don't have the right to approve or disapprove of Healy's religious beliefs.
That was actually very alarming to me. They do not have the authority to determine, you know, whether his theology is correct or not. It's outside of their capacity.
Healy is represented by Matt Bowman of the Alliance Defense Fund.
Members of the U.S. military should never be forced to make an unconstitutional choice between honoring their country and honoring their faith.
Coast Guard regulations state religious exemptions for the vaccine are granted to accommodate doctrinal religious beliefs. Which beliefs are not for the military to decide?
The First Amendment does not allow the government to declare that a religious believer is not orthodox enough or he doesn't sufficiently hold to the tenets of his own church.
He says it's a rare example of an actual violation of the separation of church and state. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
The vaccine line can be traced back to the abortion of a 14-week-old preborn baby in the 1970s. The baby was deliberately infected with hepatitis A, then aborted and dissected. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Have you put off getting an associate's, bachelor's, or MBA? Concordia University St. Louis Center offers a fully accredited Christian liberal arts education. Concordia University, 314-984-8840. Concordia University is located near the intersection of 44 and 270. Professional education with a personal touch. Concordia University, 984-8840. Here's what Dr. Dale Meyer has to say about the Issues Etc. book of the month for January, titled Visitation. Quote, "Visitation is an essential tool for comforting others in their difficult times," unquote. You can find out more about this resource by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or look for the cover of Visitation on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Visitation costs $27.99 plus shipping and handling. The title again is Visitation.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Talking about the New Hampshire primaries the day after. Dr. Jeff Walls, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin, is our guest. He's also author of the book Lutheran Pastors and Politics. A couple of other things I want to discuss with you in our limited time here. Let's talk about the speeches, if we could. Could you just compare your own opinions on the four speeches given last night, but compare them head-to-head, McCain with Romney and Barack Obama with Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, McCain with Romney, I got a sense, that McCain, there's a surge among his campaign right now. There's a sense of optimism. There's a sense for McCain, I think, of vindication that I sensed from his speech that, you know, he's always been one who said, I'm the straight shooter. His bus is named the Straight Talk Express, and he's going to level with the American people. That's kind of been his badge of honor, and I think people certainly buy that. So his speech was trying to hone those kinds of skills, trying to tell people that, you know, with the Iraq war, I was critical of the war effort. I supported the surge. I've been very consistent. Now the surge is working, and so, you know, my word is my honor. And he feels he's got some legs with that theme, and I think his speech certainly resonated with that. You know, Romney had to certainly try and make the best of the situation here, and again suggest that this is still early, suggest that for traditional Republicans that there is perhaps more friendly ground to come. And I think what I sensed in both of these two is not wanting to go too negative, certainly, because there's a certain fatigue. We've had such a long campaign. We've had so many candidates, so many debates, you know, so much negativity to a point that after this kind of a race last night, I don't think the public was looking for negativity, and I think the candidates tried to follow suit. On the other side, just quickly, this theme of change is still fascinating. You know, clearly Obama was not expecting the results, as no one was, but you know, he gave credit to Hillary for a job well done, again going positive. And I think Hillary, not, you know, wanting to be too overconfident, felt that this would propel her. And I just get a sense from both of these comparisons and from the other speeches that there's a great sense of that this is a different kind of political environment this year, given just the times, given the calendar, given a lot of other factors, that it's going to be very idiosyncratic to a sense, and perhaps unexpected twists and turns to come. And people wanting to remain part of that, Edwards wanting to remain part of that on the Democratic side, and on the Republican side, a number of other candidates. So it seemed to me with the speeches, the candidates still trying to keep their feet inside the door, recognizing this, that this might be a unique and a special campaign season.
Talk about the Democratic turnout, which is the other, I think, probably the second biggest story so far in the presidential race, is that people who are self-identifying as Democrats are turning out in pretty big and increasing numbers.
Yeah, huge numbers we saw in Iowa. You know, record turnouts in Iowa, just almost doubling the previous amounts of turnout. And I think a couple of things: a sense that President Bush has been in office, and among Democrats, certainly Democrats are trying to unite around a candidate. So that instead of a Republican president, there'll be a Democratic president. And so just a sense there of, I think, on the Democratic side of kind of Bush fatigue, and a sense that we want to be energized and we want to win. And let's see who can carry that torch for us. And also the ability, as I alluded to before, of Obama really to fire up some of the younger Democratic voters. He got apparently a lot of them out in Iowa. They supported him, and in New Hampshire as well. Obama did very well among the young in New Hampshire. So those two things, I think, are really driving Democratic turnout. And I think Democrats are optimistic, too, about 08 with the House and the Senate. The Senate looks, you know, at this point at least, fairly safe for the Democrats. The House, we'll have to see how that goes. It's always more unpredictable. But I think the Democrats just sense some momentum right now.
What do you think will be the biggest issue, if one could be picked out, when we get to November 2008 and it comes down to a two-person race?
Well, it will depend in part upon our international situation, how Iraq is doing, Afghanistan, perhaps Pakistan, Iran, perhaps. If those situations are somewhat stable, which of course is a relative term, then you come back to domestic issues, which I think we're seeing more of now. Certainly the economy, I think, will be a big issue with much uncertainty. Immigration seems to be an issue to me in November that could be significant, because that's an issue where, we have differences, significant differences on the Iraq war. Although the progress there has kind of muted that a bit. There are some differences on economics, of course, but we haven't seen as much of that at least play out. But immigration is a big one where you tend to have Republicans on one side of the issue wanting more of a law enforcement model, and you tend to have Democrats wanting a more of a simulation model, although certainly some go back and forth on that. So that, to me, the immigration issue, given the numbers of illegal immigrants, given the stakes here, that could be one of the issues, one of the kind of wild card issues that, depending upon who the nominees are, certainly could be very central to the race.
Finally, what happens if a Ron Paul or perhaps even a Michael Bloomberg decide to run as independent?
Yeah. Yeah, if that were to happen, I think we'd see another potential 92 situation in 92. Of course, we had Ross Perot with George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton. And, you know, Perot was very strong, and based on the research, took votes primarily from the Republican Party and may have cost Herbert Walker a re-election bid there. So I think if you have a Ron Paul who's a Republican, you have a Bloomberg who would be independent, but certainly would have some conservative leanings on some issues. If you have either of those come in, maybe a Bloomberg with a Chuck Hagel, who's a senator, Nebraska senator, that would certainly, I think, be more dangerous politically to the Republicans than to the Democrats.
How stung is the press going to be when they cover the next primary, given the fact that they, for other reasons, largely due to the polls everyone was reading, just got it wrong in advance in New Hampshire?
That's a good question, Todd. I just don't know exactly what the press will do with its coverage. There's kind of been a sense, I think, at least anecdotally and impressionistically, that the press likes Obama because he's kind of, you know, a breath of fresh air and those kinds of things. And there's been more attention on the Democratic side, it seems to me, as well, for a number of reasons. But I think one lesson for the press and the media and for all of us is just, again, the unpredictability of the electorate, the unpredictability of the races, and how even, you know, fairly good, fairly scientific polling, we think, still is missing the mark in this election at times.
Dr. Jeff Walls is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's co-author of the book Lutheran Pastors and Politics. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the election process. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Well, we're going to turn our attention to some news that we came across the other day having to do with abstinence education. Some states are refusing federal funding for abstinence-based sex education. They're saying it doesn't work. I want to know, what does it mean, it doesn't work? Wendy Wright will join us here in just a moment, president of Concerned Women for America in Washington, D.C. Before we welcome Wendy, let's hear the story from CBS News on states rejecting federal funding for abstinence-based sex ed programs.
In the sexually charged world of teenagers, it can be tough to just say no.
It's difficult to really be abstinent until marriage, because it's a lot of different things pulling at you when you're a teenager.
Including pop culture, like the news that the 16-year-old sister of Britney Spears is pregnant. All those influences are why Congress and the Bush administration have pushed abstinence-only education, providing states $1 billion over the past decade for abstinence-only programs. But too many say it just doesn't work, pointing to the teen birth rate, which just went up for the first time in 15 years. And so a growing number of states are taking a stand and actually rejecting federal abstinence-only funds. New Mexico just became the 15th.
Governors are saying, even if this administration is continuing to try to push abstinence-only, we in the states are going to do the right thing by teens and actually give them the information they need to prevent an unintended pregnancy.
No states require abstinence-only education in school. The federal money they're giving up is for outside groups to promote abstinence. Rejecting the funds is more a position statement by governors who believe teens need to know about birth control, too. States are split as to exactly what they want taught. 14 require both abstinence and contraception be taught in sex ed. 19 states only require abstinence, but contraception may be taught. 17 states don't tell their local school boards what to do. Those who want teens to wait to have sex are upset that so many states are turning down abstinence funds.
I think they are victims of a huge lobbying effort on behalf of the contraception education proponents who truly do not want abstinence education to exist.
As the adults debate,
so many people have had sex and had sexual experiences, so you sort of feel left out.
America's teens are left to deal with the pressure. Cheryl Atkinson, CBS News, Washington.
Wendy Wright joins us, president of Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C., and a regular guest here on the program. Wendy, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
So why have 15 states so far rejected federal funding for abstinence only for these outside groups to do the programs.
That one person who was quoted in the CBS News hit the nail on the head. It's because there's been a massive lobbying effort on the part of groups that profit from the comprehensive sex ed programs. Groups that promote the comprehensive sex ed have received $12 in federal funding for every $1 that the abstinence groups get. So when you consider that the comprehensive sex ed programs have been taught in schools for well over 30 years, have had a horrible failure rate, they can't show any success in reducing the initiation of sexual activity among young people, in reducing the number of cases of sexually transmitted diseases, in reducing the number of cases of pregnancy among teens or abortions. Huge failure on all those counts. We only started to see success on each of those levels when abstinence education started being taught and getting funded. And sadly, those groups see the abstinence education as competition to them. And they've had a tremendous lobbying level on both the lobbying effort on the state and the federal level to get states to first believe this idea that the abstinence education has not been successful, and then get them to turn down the funding. That way, the comprehensive sex ed programs don't have competition, so it's not so obvious what a failure they've been.
So this is as much a PR and image-shaping lobbying effort as anything else.
It is, and it's really quite distressing to see how successful they've been. They have certain sound bites, talking points, such as there's no evidence that abstinence education works. Well, that's blatantly false. There are a number of studies. In fact, just in Virginia recently, a study that was done by an objective group at one of the abstinence programs being used in the Virginia schools found that well over 50% of the students delayed sexual activity. Well, that's by far better than any comprehensive sex ed program. But would you believe the same week that that study result was released, the governor of Virginia announced that he, through a budget cut, was not going to allow for any state spending on abstinence programs, although he was going to continue the funding of comprehensive sex ed programs. So the comprehensive sex ed groups have been tremendously successful at creating a perception that the abstinence education has been a failure. And I am disappointed in that CBS piece in that they only interviewed one student who talked about how difficult it is to abstain from sex, which, of course, we all agree with for young people. But they should have also talked with someone who'd been through an abstinence program and could have talked about, because of how they were equipped through that program, they had the self-confidence and the discipline to refrain from sexual activity outside of marriage so that they could reach the goals that they've set for themselves.
We're often told, and it's often said, that the Bush administration has been pushing abstinence only. Is this actually true? Has the Bush administration been pushing abstinence only over against comprehensive sex ed?
The Bush administration has allowed for some funding to go to the abstinence education. Now, the funding originally began in 1996 with the Welfare Reform Act, but President Bush's own personal belief in the effectiveness of abstinence education lent the kind of weight that was needed to allow for more funding. But, as I mentioned, only $1 is spent on abstinence education for every $12 that is spent on the comprehensive sex ed. So by far, in the hundreds of millions of dollars each year are spent on programs that encourage young people to be sexually active, which carries all kinds of risks of sexually transmitted diseases, of pregnancy, and the emotional problems that go along with being sexually active. So our government is funding the promotion of behavior that is harmful to young people at a far higher rate than it's funding the programs that encourage young people to do, in fact, what parents state that they want. Polling data shows that most parents want their students, their children, to be taught to be abstinent until marriage.
I sometimes compare it with DARE or other federally funded anti-drug programs. You know, Nancy Reagan was out there saying, just say no. It was a very simple and kind of a brilliant way of conceiving of how we talk about drugs in our schools. This thing, I have two kids in public school, and it's everywhere, and the message is consistent. No drugs, don't use drugs, period. Just say no, although the mottos have changed. And I don't know how successful it's been, but why can the government say, look, let's get behind abstinence when it comes to drug use, but not when it comes to sexual activity?
You're exactly right. We should be consistent when we're teaching our kids. The abstinence programs do go beyond that. They teach about relationship building. They help young people to set goals. There's one that's been tremendously effective. It was started by Elaine Bennett, the wife of Dr. Bill Bennett, been used in Washington, D.C., which is one of the most dismal school systems in the world, but especially in the United States. And they start it in fifth grade, and they help the girls to identify, what would you like to do when you're an adult? What are some goals that you would like to reach? And then they help them think through, well, what would you need to do in order to reach that goal? Well, many of the times it includes, well, I need to finish school, at least high school. I need to go to college. Well, what would you need to do in order to finish high school? And what would keep you from finishing high school? And it's a holistic approach. It's not just focused on sex, but it focuses on the whole person. And by helping the girls to identify their goals and building up a peer group, it's not just in fifth grade. They continue with these girls all the way up through high school, and they've had an over 90% success rate with these girls. In fact, so successful that they started a program for boys. And so the comprehensive sex ed programs only focus really on the plumbing and encouraging kids to be sexually active. Basically telling them, we know that you don't have any discipline, and in fact, one program we found that was funded by our federal dollars mocked abstinence, saying that, oh, sure, you can be abstinent if you're a hermit or you're so socially unacceptable nobody wants to be around you. And would you believe that some programs that promote abstinence like that actually apply to get the abstinence funding? That simply because they mention abstinence in their program, even though it's in a mocking manner, they want to use the funding that should be designated only for the programs that truly promote abstinence as a positive alternative.
How did comprehensive sex ed become the norm in sex education?
Yeah, they were the ones who created the first sex ed programs. There's one group in particular. It's called the Sexuality Information and Education Council of U.S., SECUS. And they are kind of the grandfather, the godfather of the sex ed programs. They set out whole curriculums. They get a lot of funding from the Centers for Disease Control. And for example, oftentimes you'll hear that programs are age appropriate. Well, that's a way of kind of mollifying parents and educators that, oh, well, this is an acceptable sex ed program. Well, when you actually look at what they consider age appropriate, I think you'd be as shocked as I was. And you don't have to just believe me. You can go on SECUS's own website and look up their curriculum and find what they define as age appropriate. I'll give you just one example. They consider teaching masturbation to kindergartners to be age appropriate.
When do you think just the pure statistical demographic weight will finally begin to convince people that comprehensive sex ed, as it has been kind of here established and defended in our schools and other programs, has been a disaster for America's teenagers and adolescents?
Yeah, you know, you would think that most people just look at the real-world experience, that it's those programs that have been in the schools for 30 years and have been such a dismal failure. And sadly, the groups and the people that are in charge of evaluating programs are often ones that are financially invested in the comprehensive sex ed programs. So, for example, you'll hear that, a recent study came out that showed that the abstinence programs are ineffective. Well, you kind of have to dig down to find out, well, who did that study? And sure enough, it ends up being the same people in the same groups. One group to look for, or one person to look for, is Douglas Kirby. Almost always you'll see that he's the one who's done the evaluation of the programs and find that abstinence programs are ineffective. Well, it turns out Douglas Kirby is a senior research scientist at ETR Associates. What is ETR Associates? They produce comprehensive sex ed programs. So one of the biggest problems that we have is that those who get quoted in the media are the ones who are invested in the comprehensive sex ed programs. They're oftentimes the ones who get the government grants in order to do the evaluations. So we're at a huge disadvantage. What it's really going to take is for parents to be actively involved in their local schools and their school districts and say, we want abstinence to be taught in our schools, and they need to be actively involved in finding out what is being taught in our classrooms, to not just be assuaged with nice phrases like the curriculum is age appropriate, but to look at the curriculum itself and even sit in a classroom to find out what's being taught in schools.
And then finally, as this battle continues to wage, someone says, look, I've listened to you, Wendy, and it sounds like what you're in favor of is just kind of putting our heads in the sand, telling the kids not to have sex, period, and not giving them any further education whatsoever.
Oh, then in that case, I would encourage you to look at these abstinence ed programs and find how comprehensive they are in dealing with students as a whole person and how they really help kids to walk through what they need in order to make right choices in life. There's a fascinating study done at Tufts University a couple of years ago where they asked young women, what is it you would like to learn in a sex ed program? And would you believe over 70% of the young women said, we want to learn how to say no. This is what the students want. They feel intense pressure from our culture, from their peers, to be sexually active. And many of them just want the tools, and they want the encouragement that they don't have to be sexually involved. That, in fact, it's the best choice for them and for every young person to abstain from sexual activity until you're married, until you're ready to have a child. Don't put yourself at risk of getting a sexually transmitted disease that could take away your ability to ever have a child. It could even take away your life, as there are diseases that can lead to cancers that are life-threatening, or HIV/AIDS. So as we equip students with full information so that they can make the right choices, and instead of giving them information that is persuading, encouraging them, expecting of them to be sexually active, I think that we'll find a greater success among young people in making the right choices.
Will the 2008 presidential outcome have any bearing on funding for abstinence programs in schools?
It would be huge, because there are a number of candidates who are full force in support of the groups that back comprehensive sex ed programs, like Planned Parenthood. In fact, several of the candidates spoke at the Planned Parenthood annual conference. Now, Planned Parenthood benefits from kids being sexually active. When you look at the services that Planned Parenthood provides, testing for pregnancy, sexually transmitted disease testing, abortions, one-third of their income comes from abortions, you find that they profit from kids being sexually active. They have absolutely no incentive in encouraging kids to not be sexually active. So if a candidate is actively seeking the endorsement and aligns themselves with Planned Parenthood, that's a pretty good indication that they're going to fight against any funding going to responsible programs.
CWFA.org is a website address for Concerned Women for America. CWFA.org. Wendy Wright is president of Concerned Women for America, based in Washington, D.C. Wendy, it's always a pleasure. Keep up the good work, and thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back from this break, we got the third hour of Issues, Etc. straight ahead. And in that third hour, I've got a very simple question, and there really is no wrong answer here. But what I want from you is simply what your favorite Bible passage is and why. Well, this is occasioned by the fact that there's a website address out of Australia where they're trying to figure out how often certain Bible passages are cited on the web. Of course, the web is an awfully big place. They've surveyed 37 million sites, and they say they've come up with the top 10 Bible passages. I'm wondering which is your favorite and why after this.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.